You know, I feel like if it's not scaring us, what are we doing? What's happening? You know, we're making a comedy, I guess. I don't know. I don't make those.
Thanks for joining us for the very first episode of Trade Secrets, an HBO Max podcast where you get to listen in on an intimate and unexpected conversation between two great storytellers. Today, we have an endearing and informative conversation where Misha Green interviews Camila Forbes. They are two multi-hyphenates, as they say, who are making compelling content for the screen and the stage. Misha is the creator and showrunner of HBO's drama Lovecraft Country, starring Jonathan Majors and Journey Smollett. She also made her episodic directing debut on the 8th episode of the series. Camila is the director and executive producer of the film adaptation of the Ta-Nehisi Coates memoir, Between the World and Me. She also directed the theatrical adaptation that premiered at Harlem's historic Apollo Theater, where she heads up creative as the Apollo's executive producer. Misha and Camila discuss what it's like to be both a player and a coach in Hollywood, as Misha puts it. It's a candid, funny, enlightening conversation about finding home on set, in music, in Black institutions, and beyond. They also take us inside the process of creating Lovecraft Country and Between the World and Me, from working with the actors to the ways that filming during a pandemic changed everything. It's a delightful listen. So here's Misha and Camila.
Hi, Camila.
Hey, Misha.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing good. So before we started, you told me that you were in 3 rap groups.
I knew this was going to come back. Yep. I sure did.
3.
I did.
Okay. I want to know, what were the names of these rap groups? And then I will reserve my next question until I find that out. So.
Okay. All right. So the first one was Daughters of the Cypher. Get it? Cypher,
yes.
Right? We were like the female Wu-Tang Clan. There was 12 of us.
12?
yeah. And you know, some played instruments. Like, you had a sax player, drummer, bass player. Yeah, it was deep. The next group I was in was called Shy Garden. Because I'm from Chi-Town, and my partner in the group, Meredith, was from New Jersey, the Garden State.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Shy Garden. And the next one was when I went solo and was Killa Cam. This was pre-Cameron.
Killa Cam.
Exactly. And that's the one that stuck. That's the name, not the group or the career. Only the name.
You said this thing, which is the reason you're a multi-hyphenate started from creating space for people. And I've recently become obsessed with this, like, in pleasure activism. There was an essay and someone said they readied the ground for the next person. And I was like, oh my God, that's insane. So who readied the ground for you? Who created space for you? Or did that come from that no one was there to create space for you?
God, wow. Yes, pleasure activism. Shout out Adrienne Marie Brown. So you know what? That's such a great question. And I think that, there have always been people creating space for me, unbeknownst to them, whether it was intentional or not. I would say that it probably, you know, when I think about people who inspired me along my journey, I think they were key family members who I really encouraged, because I think the arts in this field of arts and culture was not one that, you know, my family had any real clue around guidance.
Right. You were going for medical, pre-med first?
Yes.
Me too.
You were. See, mm-hmm. this is why I said yes. And so, you know, that was like the path. But my part was other places. And, you know, I had one uncle who gave me this article of this director who was on Broadway, who was also of Caribbean parentage. And I felt like that became my first mentor. right, was that article, that obituary of this woman who was not here any longer. But knowing that there was a path, there was someone who had taken that path and taken certain steps. So I would say, you know, that was probably one of the first. And then there were other mentors along the way of meeting people in the field and arts and culture and television entertainment. One of my other mentors, Stan Lathan, I think I worked for him. And he very intentionally, and he does this for a lot of people, I think really readies the ground, right? And knows that, you know, his job is, yes, obviously he is a director and a producer, but also his job is much larger than that, to make space for other people.
And how do you do both? Because I find that it's really hard to ready the ground and to be on the ground. It's kind of like being a coach and a player at the same time. So how do you juggle that?
Yeah, I think it's at some point it almost just becomes just a part of how you walk through the world, right? Is that there's always... we're always going to be in a state of learning. We're always going to be in a state of doing. But I think that there's certain points where it's like, how can we always also be in a state of teaching? Even if it's not intentional, right. If it's not like I'm setting a syllabus for this next person, but just being aware that, well, someone could be watching, or someone should be watching. How do I make sure that someone's in this room with me?
Right.
You know?
I'm going to create a syllabus for the next person. Now that you just said that, I was like, I would have liked a syllabus. I would have liked to know what the going into directing and all that stuff, what it is exactly the point by point things we're going to do daily. That would be great.
Yeah, it would be, right? But you also make the road while walking. I mean, look at your journey. First of all, can we just say how much I stan you? Can I just get that out
Thank
the way
you.
Real quick? So, like, let's just start there. But I'm, you know, when I think about multi-hyphenate, that's you. I mean, not as a writer, producer, director, but also how you mix aesthetics.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
I mean, you're doing the same, though. That's the thing. I think we're both moving in that mixing of aesthetics and going, how do we bring this to this to this and nothing can. I think back to, like, Deaf Poetry Jam and Brave New Voices. And I was just like, oh, okay. Yeah, you can make this TV show of this thing that's on stage, but you can find the way to bridge those things. And to me, I get bored easily. So that's where that starts for me, because I'm just like, I need a lot of stimuli, or I'm going, what's happening? What are we waiting for? What are we doing?
Interesting. Because I kept, you know, that's so, I think I'm the same. I liked that constant changing and switching and unexpected.
Yes, that surprise.
The elements of surprise where it takes people off guard and therefore forces them to lean in further.
Right. Let's talk home. Home, the word home. The Apollo Theater. That is a home now. Tell me about what that home means to you.
The Apollo, I have been there since 2016 as the executive producer. And interestingly enough, when I took the post, I was not looking for a job like that. I liked my life of being a freelance director. I had my own organization, much smaller organization, but I liked that complete flexibility. But this came up, and it was a real opportunity to build roots in a Black space. And that really spoke to me. I went to school at Howard University, and that's another place that's very near and dear to my heart, because it really formed, I think, who I am and my worldview, and also the safety I feel in spaces in which our voices, our stories, our humanity is centered. Not an afterthought, right. not ancillary, not on the fringes, but it is the thing. So the more and more I thought about it, I was super excited. And also to be coming into this legacy institution at a point where, you know, our job as creatives is like, how do we vision the future? How do you look at a blank page and think of like the wildest things that would move people. And I think my job is something similar to that, but for the future of a Black cultural institution. And that excites me.
Was it ever intimidating? Were you ever like, this Apollo stage is too big of a stage? Now, did you find yourself going, you know, because even with HBO, I think, you know, it's like with Underground, it was on WGN. It's not quite the same thing. So you have this bigger platform. More people are going to be interacting with it. More people that aren't just Black people. Was that, did you ever have like that? Ooh.
Yes. Yes. I mean, when I was interviewing, and I had consulted with them before, so I knew the team, so it was comfortable. But I was like, they're not going to give me this job. They're not going to give me this job. Let me just keep talking to them and blah, it'll be great, but they're not going to get this to me. And then when they did, I was like, wait, what? And walking in on my first day, thinking that all of the people that have walked across this stage and that hold this building in such reverence. You know, you say Apollo around the world and people know it. I mean, I was so used to like projects I was directing in theater and you say it and people are like, wait, huh? You know, you got to explain a few other sentences, you know? But, you know, this was something different where people had a real emotional attachment to it. And I think the largeness of that it was intimidating and still is intimidating. Right, because it's one of those symbolic buildings that everyone has sort of a different relationship point to.
Right. So when was your first feeling of you were like, okay, it's the Apollo, but I gotta come in. I gotta do the next part of the Apollo. Tell us about a time when you felt that, if you felt it.
Yeah. You know, there was my first board meeting. And I remember my boss, and these are like high-powered corporate folks who like run corporations and like you see them in the New York Times every day and they sit around this big board meeting. And she was like, okay, so I think I might've been there a few weeks. She was like, tell them your vision. We want to see your vision, want to know your vision of the Apollo, this almost 100-year-old institution. And I was like, wait, what? I don't even know where the bathrooms are. And you want me? But it was in that moment, it was like, all right, you know, where again, you dig in the well of creativity and start to imagine, okay, well, what's the future? What is the future of a safe Black space mm-hmm. where all the people that I admire and get energy from and am inspired by can come and incubate? Mm-hmm. Like that started getting me excited. And that's at that point, I was like, all right, yeah, okay, let's go. This is not just the Apollo. This is now our Apollo that we're building.
Right.
And that's, I think it was at that point when you really have to start to speak truth, mm-hmm. right? You have to like speak it into existence where it starts to become real.
What is the next phase of our Apollo? Now we've been in a pandemic. I always get a little when people are like, the pandemic's over. It's like, it's not over. It's still happening globally, guys. But now that people are living their vaxxed lives, yeah. you know, what?
Yes.
What? I'm out here for vax summer, by the way.
I love it. Yes, vax summer.
What's the next step for Apollo? What's the next step for theater? You know, it was a hard blow for a lot of the theater world. What is the next phase look like?
Well, I think the next phase for me has always, you know, and I think we talk about this a lot, has always been this idea of how do you move a building, a space from reverence to relevance. And so that's been sort of the big, and a big part of that is that we're one of the only African-American or larger performing arts institution in the country. So the real question is, how do we play a leadership role of moving culture forward? So less of around our legacy, but it's about the commissioning the big thinkers of tomorrow and creating and building culture for tomorrow. So that's the big idea. We're opening two new theaters next year.
Wow.
A 99 and a 199 seat right along that will be a part of the Apollo Theater Performing Arts Center campus. We are announcing, you know, we have a bevy of artists in residence. Our first was Ta-Nehisi Coates, or is Ta-Nehisi Coates. He's still in his residency.
And like you already try to push him out the door.
I know. I'm like, who's next? All right, next. That's cool. You wrote some stuff.
Right.
Cool.
You did a little something. No big deal.
You did a little something. You cool. But who's next? You know? But I'm now like, yeah, it's that exciting. Like, how can it be sort of this national repository of Black genius?
Yes. That's dope.
That's what we're looking to do. So we're building program initiatives that really speak to that, like the residency program, like the commissioning program, and then also looking for cross-pollination. I mean, Between the World and Me was exciting because it was something that we developed for the stage, right, for the live space. And then the pandemic was like, yeah, whatever. Mm-hmm. You can't tour that work. Figure it out. And hence making a film. So now, you know, we've always had a foothold in the media space, but now that's been accelerated. And finding way in which our ideals express themselves across platforms, many different platforms.
So where do I sign up?
Listen,
that all sounds amazing.
You trying to be an artist in resident? What's up, Misha Green?
Like, what? I was like, wow. I was like, that all sounds amazing. From reverence to relevance. I just wanted to repeat that. I do a thing. Yeah. I repeat things when I'm like, oh, I'm stealing that clearly for something. I got to repeat it in my head. That's dope. I feel like the same. A lot of, you know, the questions I get asked about Underground, about Lovecraft, it's about, oh, it's set in the past. And it's like, yes, one of the ways we make it relevant, at least for me again, is music.
Yes.
And it's a big, to me, music is timeless. You can listen to something from the 1920s and today I'm like, oh, that's a bop. Wow.
That's
okay.
That's it.
And then you can listen to something today, even though I am getting older now. So some of the stuff I'm like, what are these kids listening to now? What is this? I'm like, I'm that person.
Yeah.
But music, tell me how music has influenced what you do.
Yeah. It has been the bedrock because music is such a signifier. It's a signifier of energy. But music for me gave me voice, honestly. I remember in grade school, you know, hearing, being influenced by hip hop in middle school and feeling the sense of like empowerment, mm-hmm, feeling the sense of like my back felt a little bit straighter, mm-hmm, you know, my shoulders rolled back. And for a Black girl growing up in the suburbs of Chicago, that was necessary for my own like sanity and survival. You know, living in a world in which my identity was not being validated, but through this music, through this sound, through this culture that was all about validation, that was all about bigging up your chest, mm-hmm, that was all about, I'm here, look at me.
Right.
That's what it's done for me. And I think, and that's hip hop in particular, but I think music as a whole, and more importantly, it's a vibe. You know, it's so funny watching a film without sound. And the second, that score drops in, all of a sudden, it's a brand new experience. It signals how you should be watching.
Right.
What is your entry point?
I think, you know, for me, it's also that thing is you kind of have to have that hype as a Black artist in Hollywood, especially. Mm. Hollywood is a very white commercial space. Have you encountered that? Do you have to get yourself hype, or has it been a breeze? I feel like I know the answer already to that last part. I just
you always got to get yourself hype. I think, you know, and I love that you said that. You know, I think as a Black artist, this is the world. Our existence in this country lives in opposition to our sheer existence. So therefore, there is always the push. There is always that like, what we up against today. There's going to always be there. But that's also part of our beauty, right? because we've got to push, there, you know, against pressure, diamonds are made, right?
Yeah.
So it's that pressure that, you know, again, like a beautiful culture like hip hop is born, a beautiful culture like Black culture is born, right? Like all of our cultural movements, the way in which we storytell, it all is born from that in opposition too. So to answer your original question, a breeze, no, but what I will say is that I find joy in creating spaces that ultimately do become a breeze. Mm-hmm. And it may be a journey getting to building those spaces, but I do find joy and solace in that. You know, almost like creating your own little like enclave,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Your own little oasis. And I
haven't figured out how to do that, but yes.
I'm sure, but look, I would think that, like, you know, in your rooms, you know, when you're with your smaller, you know, in those smaller spaces. Nah. Okay.
Places of opposition only because we're pushing story, you know, we're going to the places that are uncomfortable and dealing in stuff, as you know, generational trauma, enslavement, all of that stuff. Those are hard places to go, you know?
Right.
And I feel like, so
that's right.
It's always like, oh, it's yay. It starts the yay. And then you're in there and you're like, man, we are really
this is rough.
Spending 2 days talking about child abuse.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Wow. That's awkward, you know? So,
that's real.
But I feel like those are the places you have to go when it scares you.
That's right.
You know, I feel like if it's not scaring us, what are we doing? What's happening?
What are we doing? Exactly.
We're making a comedy, I guess. I don't know. Yeah. I don't make those.
Yes, me either. Clearly.
What song do you listen to that's like your I'm ready to go? Nobody better fuck with me.
Yeah. Honestly, Shook Ones. Mobb Deep.
Shook Ones.
That is, I am ready for anything.
Yeah.
I could be ready for war. I could be ready to go shopping. I could be, I just could be ready to take it on. I could be ready to take my kid to school.
Right.
Shook Ones just gets me so high. Clearly, I'm in a different place in life right now. So
I was thinking, what does your kid think? He's like, she or he is playing this song right now. Uh-oh, we in trouble.
We in trouble because mama's getting hype. Mama is what? Rocking. That's the one. That is the one. Do you have one?
Bia. Bia. Push it up. Bia.
Oh.
Every time. And it goes for my basketball days, too. We used to use that. Like, we used to eat Red Vines and listen to that in the locker room and jump up and down and scream and then go on the court and kill everybody. It was great.
What?
Directing.
Yes.
Directing television. Between the World and Me, directing, going back to the theater and directing. Tell me the trade secrets. I knew I was going to do that.
Slipped
I said
in.
One time, I've got to get it in. Of directing.
God, geez. Well, I need to be asking you that, Misha. Damn.
I just want to give all the Howard kids some real jewels to take back with them when they listen to this. So...
I love that you said Howard kids. Oh, he's such a cult, Howard. But yes, trade secrets. Well, it starts and ends with story. I think that's always your guide, right? It starts and ends with what's on the page. So when you get that opportunity to get that what's on the page that's exciting and exhilarating, then you're in it.
Right.
You're in it. So I think that way. I think collaboration is key. I think even as a director, my one key thing is that I'm not looking for my idea, but I'm looking for the best idea.
Right.
So how do you foster an environment in which the best idea surfaces? That can be tough.
Yes.
That can be tough because, you know, the field we work in, egos are real.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's also tough when my idea is always the best idea.
Well, there it is. Exactly. There it is. There it is. There it is.
You just touched on something that it's like, I don't think you are taught in film school. You don't taught how do you create as we've been talking about here, a safe space for the best idea to win, to push all the egos, which there are so many in Hollywood, out of the space so that creativity can be had. What little jewel do you have to do that? What's the something that you have found over the course of doing that consistently that you're like, this has to happen for this to begin, a safe space to even begin?
I think everyone knowing why they're there in the room. I always feel like people need to know why they're there. Otherwise, they'll start to flail and create reasons for themselves of why they are here that may not be in congruence with why you need them here.
Right.
So but that can also be done in a way that is validating. So I'm always like, well, how can I make sure? How can I give you time here? How can we make sure that, you know, that people feel secure in their place and in their position to play their part?
The administrative part of directing is a thing that I don't think a lot of schools talk about. We talk about the creative part, but we don't talk about, there's so much about leadership and management that goes into the role of director. Let's talk about the creative part now. Working with actors
who I love. I love me some actors, you know? Yeah. As someone also to me, another director always shared with me, you know, that actors are, I mean, they're critical to our craft, right? And so how, and part of that feeling secure a lot of times deals with how we deal with actors as well. How do we make sure that they feel as secure as possible? Because what we're asking them to do, quite frankly, is to be naked.
Yes.
Literally to be naked. So how can you make sure that they feel comfortable stripping of themselves and bearing their soul? The more secure, the more vulnerable, and the better the truth then will come across on screen.
Yeah.
And that's something I think, you know, funny, I think even in school, we learn technical, but sometimes that interpersonal play is something that I learned by watching other directors work. I learned by watching other directors not do that too.
Yes, that part. Learn a lot by being like, ooh, that is not what
that
to
is
do.
Not
got
what
it.
To do. You know, and yeah. But I think, you know, making them feel comfortable. Sometimes I like, and a lot of directors do this, but, you know, I like coming close to have conversations, which was very hard in COVID. Creating that sense of intimacy, that sense of conversation, that sense of how do we draw sort of your own, so that you can draw your own kind of personal pathway into this role, into this moment, into this beat, by creating that closeness, which unfortunately we were unable to do during COVID, but, you know, you do what you can.
Yeah. COVID, between the world and me.
Yes, yes.
Socially distanced. During an election year. During a pandemic.
Who does that?
Did the material shift for you in that time? Did you see something new that you hadn't, because you had been working with it before?
So I think the new that came from the material was a need to be more intimate. I was originally enamored from the material, given the content and given the language. I think that's just the, you know, language freak in me, that I just love the poetry of the language, which, you know, it played well on stage. But now that we were in this pandemic and couldn't connect with one another at a time in which our people, the country, right, are needing to heal, needing to connect with one another, like needing to reach out and be closer. That is what unlocked then for me in the script was, well, how can we get as close as possible to one another? How can we, you know, like really look into each other's homes, into each other's lives as if I know and can truly feel who is on the other side of the screen in a way that we would never, ever be able to. So that's mm-hmm. like why let's go close. Let's shoot in people's homes. I want to see what's around. I'm in your home. You're in my home. The pandemic really unlocked that in a way for me that I think if we were to make a film of this 2 years ago, it would be completely different, you know. But it was in response to the need of wanting to be close, wanting to kind of shorten that gap. And then also, you know, even with casting, casting sort of very notable visual people that you know, and you're, oh, Courtney B. Vance, Angela Bassett. Yes, we know them. But how mm-hmm. can we show them in a way that is far more intimate, in a way that we're not seeing them as actors playing a character, but we're seeing them as a mother and a father of teenage twins.
Right.
We're seeing Yara Shahidi as a sister, Joe Morton as a father of children, you know, a protector, you know. So trying to find that sort of intimacy and balance was definitely something that unlocked for me. So then finding language that was far more intimate in the book.
Mm-hmm. Being as singular, and you must extend that same respect into the past. Slavery is not an indefinable mass of flesh. It is a particular, specific, enslaved woman whose mind is active as your own, whose range of feeling is as vast as your own, who prefers the way the light falls in one particular spot in the woods, who loves her mother in her own complicated way, thinks her sister talks too loud, has a favorite cousin, a favorite season, who excels at dressmaking, and knows inside herself that she is as intelligent and capable as anyone. For this woman, enslavement is not a parable. It is damnation. It is the never-ending night, and the length of that night is most of our history. The enslaved were not bricks in your road, and their lives were not chapters in your redemptive history. They were people turned to fuel for the American machine, and it is wrong to claim our present circumstance, no matter how improved, as the redemption for the lives of people who never asked for the posthumous, untouchable glory of dying for their children. I love you, and I love the world, and I love it more with every new inch I discover. But you are a black boy. You cannot forget how much they took from us, how they transfigured our very bodies into sugar, tobacco, cotton.
That was one of the things that surprised me about it, that I was like, oh. Mm. I was like, being inside your home, this is not so much of a production. It's the intimacy that you talked about. It's like, how do you find that? And I think that's a thing I'm always interested in as well, is the intimacy of it, even in a narrative, even where there's monsters. It's like, if it's not hitting you in this, like sitting across from somebody and experiencing it firsthand, then what are we doing?
Yes, that's exactly right. That's why I know you're asking me. I keep coming back to Lovecraft, because that's was the brilliance of it. I'm on this journey. I mean, there were so many things of sci-fi monsters, history, love story, and unlocking family secrets all at the same time, you know, because I don't come from, I'm spewing, but sci-fi has never necessarily been my genre. I'm actually very scared of horror movies, but this, you can find a way in, and you're on that ride and you are coasting.
I mean, I am a huge horror fan. I love it. I love to be scared. It's really great, exciting for me. But I also think that the best horror is when you have that entryway. And I think that I also love the version where you don't have that entryway because I love it all. But the best one, the most, the stuff that I get, I leave with still filling it has that. And I think that's an element of any project. It's like you want that intimacy. You want to have entered into a space you not necessarily would have gone. But now you find yourself there and you're like, this is also home because right. It has been explained and given to me in a way where it can bring us all together because we're all just human beings at the end of the day. What are some new spaces you would like to go in and find yourself at home?
To find myself at home. I don't know if this is quite new, but I think a narrative drama for television. I love intimate stories on the stage, but like a true narrative. I mean, you know, Between the World and Me was such a mashup. But that's where I think I'd like to explore.
What would it be about? What's your show about? I'm already writing it in my head. Let's go.
You know, I've always been fascinated, and you know, we always start with this autobiographical journey. Mm-hmm. But I've been fascinated with 1950s Jamaica, which is a family drama that really encapsulates that particular period of time.
Yeah. I'm watching it. HBO's listening right now.
There we go. Yeah, there we go. That's the pitch. That's the pitch.
Yeah. Well, we will welcome more Black voices in narrative TV making all the time. I say, come on in for sure.
Come on in. There we go. There we go. When you talk about making for Lovecraft Country yours, right? It was adapted from the book. What do you think was your chief guiding principle for making it yours?
Ooh, I didn't have one. Mm. You know, I feel like, you know, I just go, that's dope, that's dope, that's dope. We got to put all of that in there. Mm. And then we have to go, what is it? It's different formats too, a book, a novel. It's much easier to change things when you're like, it's a novel. We've got to now make it a TV show. We've got to live with these characters for 10 episodes. We have to be in it. And so I think my only guiding principle when I adapt is really nothing sacred.
Got you. Yeah.
Like nothing sacred. We can do whatever we want. We can turn Horace into a girl. Yes. We can turn Caleb into Christina. It's whatever we want to do. Yeah. And because at the end of the day, you know who's going to get blamed for it.
Yes.
Me. So I'm like, I'm going to just change what I want to change because either way, people are going to be like, what is this? What were you doing? And I'm like, if I follow the book exactly to the T, they would have been like, what is it? What are you doing?
Yeah.
So it's like that, I feel like, frees me.
That's right.
You know, and I go, that's nothing right. sacred. It's that's the right. same with history where people were like, you're doing a thing about enslaved people.
Yeah. Yeah.
But don't you think that they can't, don't show them bad. Yeah. They have to all be like good, right? Mm. And I was like, I don't think they were. So no.
Mm. Mm.
It's not sacred.
Not sacred. I love that. I love that. Well, that's inspiring. I'll take that into my adaptation for my 1950s Jamaica narrative.
Exactly. I'm excited. This has been amazing. So fun.
It's been so fun talking to you. I mean, and such a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Trade Secrets. You can stream all of Lovecraft Country and the film version of Between the World and Me right now on HBO Max. And make sure to check out the podcasts Lovecraft Country Radio and Between the World and Me wherever you listen. Each episode of Trade Secrets will feature a different pair of creative pros from some of the most talked about content on HBO Max. And the conversations will drop on a surprise schedule. So if you haven't already, definitely make sure you subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. We have some amazing duos coming up that you don't want to miss, so stay tuned. Trade Secrets is a production of HBO Max and Pineapple Street Studios. Beyondria July produces the show. Brianna Garrett is our associate producer. Our editor is Darby Maloney. Hannes Brown is our engineer. Gabrielle Lewis is our senior managing producer. Our executive producers are Barry Finkel, Jenna Weiss-Berman, and Max Linsky. To support the show, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts. And tell a friend. Until next time.